Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical liberalism. I'm Aaron Ross Powell. Kathy Reisenwitz's Sex and the State is one of the handful of newsletters I consider indispensable. She writes, from what I'd label a radical liberal perspective, about culture and gender in ways I consistently find illuminating. And she was my guest on episode 50 of this show on misogyny and the political divide, which remains one of my favorites. So when she and I were recently chatting about the future of the liberty movement and what's needed in our authoritarian moment, I wanted to get her back on. We discuss her early days in the liberty movement, why she left, what's brought her back, and what she learned in the intervening years. Then we discuss making the case for liberty and why the right's focus on cultural issues has given it a leg up in persuading many Americans to its side. A strong case for liberty demands taking social issues seriously and interrogating social patterns and their origins. Before we turn to my conversation with Kathy, I wanted to let you know there's an easy and free way you can listen to Reimagining Liberty without interruptions from ads and sponsorships. Just head to my Patreon and click join for free. You'll get a special feed you can add to your favorite podcast app that doesn't contain any ads. You'll also get my new essays sent to your inbox. And if you value Reimagining Liberty and want to support the show, there are options for that too. As a supporter, you'll get all new episodes a full week early. To learn more, check out my Patreon at patreon.com/AaronRossPowell or look for the link in the show notes. With that, here's my discussion with Kathy. You were, for a lot of years, pretty involved in the libertarian movement and libertarian organizations. You worked for Students for Liberty. And then, call it roughly a decade ago, you left. And the reason I reached out to you to bring you back on the show was because you were talking about wanting to get back in and this being a moment when it was important to get back in. So why? What's changed? Why now?
I mean, we're obviously in a moment of like maximum personal liberty, absolutely no threat of authoritarianism. I think it's two things. I mean, I think one, in the moment we're in, the any movement or group of individuals who kind of broadly understand the utility of Enlightenment principles, pluralism, civil liberties, due process, individualism. I think now is a good time for that. I also think that for me personally, I got really local pilled when I moved to San Francisco. And so it was a very pleasant time for me to kind of take my focus away from national and international stuff and just focus on like getting more housing built in San Francisco. And I love that. I thought we did a lot of, they're still doing a lot of good. But in Huntsville, I'm less enthused about the possibilities for positive local change. And so getting back into the national sphere, I think the other thing I think that happened is that I was excited about the possibilities of a Democratic Party that was more interested in individual liberty, free markets, anti-authoritarianism, in terms of what the Democratic Party is doing for that. I don't know if that's, I think structurally and temperamentally, there's space for libertarianism to come in and be useful.
Yeah, I had done an episode before the election with Josh Eagle about the title is something like The Democrats' New Rhetoric of Freedom. And noticing that like the Democratic Party, or at least the Harris campaign, or at least the way the Harris campaign spoke, seemed more liberty-coded than prior campaigns had been. They talked more about being, they talked about freedom and talked and like used the flag as a symbol of that in the way that prior Democratic campaigns had not or had downplayed. But they also framed themselves as like, we're the people who want to leave you alone. all those weird guys want to intervene and tell you how to live and force their strange hangups and kinks on you. And we just want to leave you alone. And I don't know to what extent that's was authentic. They're still kind of progressive Democrats after all, with everything that comes with that. But yeah, it does feel like there's this moment. And it's one of the reasons I was excited to see you in particular expressing this desire to kind of re-enter this space, because I think the kind of thinking, like your newsletter, Sex in the State, which I recommend to everyone, is consistently deep and thoughtful in engaging with, I think, the real issues, like so many of the issues that really matter to getting us through this political moment, the cultural issues, the gender issues, the social issues, that it feels like so much of the liberty movement has just for decades basically ignored. That it was everything could be explained through like economics or maybe political science, or like high rationalist political philosophy kind of arguments. But all that like messy stuff was best just kind of ignored or downplayed. Why does that matter? Like why does that get ignored, and why does that stuff matter so much?
This reminds me of another reason I think that I'm more interested in libertarianism at this point, again, is that I've been working with moderate Democrats. I chair the steering committee for the Center for New Liberalism, for example, and we just need more people. Like, I do think that there is a cohort of Democrats who are genuinely interested in, like, small L liberalism, pluralism, anti-authoritarianism. We just don't have enough of us, and we're not as well organized as we should be. As with libertarianism, it's not as diverse as it should be. It's very male, it's very white, it's very urban, it's very gay, frankly. And I think in terms of libertarianism, it's important. I mean, I started to talk about gender and race in the context of libertarianism because I come from a marketing background, and I was trying to broaden libertarianism's appeal to people who weren't cis, het, straight, white men, well-educated, high-income, able-bodied, yada, yada. And so I wanted to understand the people who libertarianism was not appealing to, understand what their concerns were, and how it seemed impossible to me that libertarianism couldn't offer them something. trying to figure out how to make a market there. I think it's a vicious cycle where the demographics create a situation in which high taxes are prioritized as a tremendous incursion on individual liberty, but the inability to obtain a legal abortion is not. And that's obviously pretty upsetting to people of women of reproductive age, and people who care about women who might get pregnant. And so, if things aren't changed, then it just continues the cycle of alienating people. And then the demographics are not such that their concerns are important in the movement, and so on and so forth. And so, I mean, I still want to break those cycles and to do individual liberty in such a way as to protect everyone's liberty, not just straight, white, well-educated men.
I think this is an important point, because it's very much, I think, what keeps the demographic of people who are self-consciously a liberty movement or libertarian non-diverse in the way that you've described, is that on the one hand, these ideas of libertarianism, radical freedom have a huge amount to say to people who are suffering in various ways, who are feeling the boot of the state, who are excluded from the economy, who are feeling oppressed, who are in marginalized groups. And often, you know, we have answers. We're like, here's, you know, this is the cause. And the problem is that they, you know, when you, a lot of the solutions that gets offered, say, by progressives or conservatives wouldn't actually ameliorate these problems. But at the same time, I think that lack of diversity, you said, if you are a racial minority or a woman or a member of a marginalized ethnic group or poor, you look at a lot of the rhetoric and it's like, these people don't care about my problems. They care about the ones that you point. They care about taxes. They care about business regulations. And all of those things matter, but there's this dismissiveness of these concerns. I remember years and years ago when I was running libertarianism.org at the Cato Institute, and the whole point of that was to reach young people, right? Like that, like bring these ideas to young people. And a survey came out of like, what political issues are most salient to young people? What are the things that they care about the most? And the list was more or less orthogonal to the list that a lot of libertarians were saying, like young people should care about. You know, like it was always, the list was like, first off, am I going to get a job when I graduate? But then after that, it was like, it was gay rights, it was environmental policy, it was criminal justice, like basically police brutality. It wasn't like bringing down the national debt, which is again, like the national debt matters, but like it's not, you know, like if, it's not something that's immediately salient to a lot of these people's lives. But there was so much skepticism of engaging in that stuff because, and I think this gets to that vicious cycle that you said, because a lot of those issues were heavily left-coded. It was like to talk about environmental issues was to be left-coded. To talk about police brutality was often to be left-coded as opposed to other forms of criminal justice reform. To talk like gay rights was the libertarian movement that was a trailblazer on gay rights, at least especially in Washington, but there was like skepticism on trans rights issues. And it was like to even kind of enter into that was to tarnish you with a sense of leftism. But it was because that was where the community was largely being pulled from people on the cultural right. And so they were comfortable in it and then didn't want to talk about it. And then people from the cultural left didn't want to enter it. And it just kept perpetuating. And I think in the current moment, that's really broken down because so much of what's going on and so many of the impositions, the authoritarian impositions we're seeing are coming from this like culturally right direction to just crush anything that smacks of the cultural left.
I think there's a huge opportunity here in that, hopefully, you know, when I was working in libertarian think tanks, the conversation was about gay marriage. And, you know, in an era when it felt like rights for queer people were expanding, and they were in certain ways, like marriage, it was, I think, harder to make the argument that, you know, this is an area of liberty that we really need to focus on, people who care about individual rights and liberty. But in an era where we've lost Roe v. Wade, where they're trying to ban birth control, where they're actively discussing, and by they, I don't mean like random internet weirdos. I mean like people in the White House and in Congress are just openly discussing ending no-fault divorce. I think it's a lot easier to make the argument that no, like individual liberty does not begin and end with tax rates or the national debt. Like this is an ideological fight for what you think America should stand for. Is it a theocracy or is it a liberal democracy?
How do we make that relevant to people? Like this is the kind of the ongoing challenge that I see is how do we break that kind of divide that the knowledge of like the libertarian knowledge, the knowledge of why you should be skeptical of the state, why state interventions don't work as well as people think, why they can lead to unintended consequences, why liberty, robust political liberty really matters, is in this community that has historically and still culturally is not receptive to a lot of what you just said. And then the people who are receptive to these challenges and these issues being really, really relevant right now. I'm thinking of also example, like there were libertarians who signed on to that Manhattan Institute statement about basically we need to turn over control of the universities to the Trump administration because the universities have gone woke and the federal government needs to dictate what's being taught or at least shut down the stuff that we don't like, which is just a profoundly anti-libertarian statement. There's like no way to rectify that with libertarian first principles. And yet, like there's just this divide and Kathy, tell me how we can bridge that or bring the insights from one side to the other, because that just, it feels desperately needed.
Well, I wish I had the answers, but two things give me something to grasp onto. I think one is that unfortunately, economic liberty, quote unquote, which I think it's a false distinction, but it's useful colloquially. It's been a good cover for social fascists, people who want to control speech and women's reproductive, healthcare and things like that. And a lot of those people have felt very comfortable in libertarianism because those issues just weren't addressed very much. And they didn't feel as comfortable in the Democratic or Republican Party apparatus. And I think a lot of those people, hopefully, I think it's unfortunate that I think a lot of those people have just moved into Republican land, but it's hopefully gotten some of them out of the libertarian institutions. And then the other thing that I look at is I remember when Obama authorized the extrajudicial killing of an American citizen and his son abroad, and the libertarians saying, including myself, saying, this is not a thing we want to be, it's not legal and it's not a thing we want to be normalized. And, you know, maybe you trust you being Democrats and Republicans, because I don't remember Republicans making a big deal about that. But, you know, for Democrats, maybe this is somebody you trust, but that office is not always going to be held by someone you trust. And so that's why you care about principles and limits on executive power. And now we've got President Trump just like authorizing extrajudicial killings for even dumber reasons. And this is an opportunity for libertarians to say, like, see, these things are important. This is why you have rules. This is why you have rule of law as opposed to rule of man. Maybe there's an opportunity there, maybe not, but these are things that I'm thinking about.
Has the experience of the two very different forms of local thinking of San Francisco versus Alabama shifted how you think about, like, has that taught, if you were talking to the Kathy of a decade ago, who's kind of very involved in the national politics side of it, as I think a lot of like the liberty movement is, it tends to nationalize. It tends to be about either kind of national party stuff or national think tanks, or you want to head off to Washington, D.C. because that's where the action is. And so the experience of being in San Francisco and then Alabama, which are very, very different places with very different political cultures and relevant issues and so on, what have you learned from that?
I think that there's what I learned is that the difference between I thought that the difference between San Francisco and Alabama would be party and ideology and, you know, demographics and things like that. I thought that Huntsville is a much better run city than San Francisco. There are lots of differences. It's lighter. It's more Republican. It's more Christian, blah, blah, blah. And so I thought that I would have an easier time getting housing reform passed in Huntsville because I thought that Huntsville's voters were going to be more pragmatic, less ideology poisoned. The fight over housing in San Francisco is like very entrenched because it's been going on at an emergency level for decades. And people are very firmly like on one side or the other of the issue. And it really isn't about facts. In terms of the opposition, it's very much like a tribalistic vibes situation. And I just didn't see like a left wing NIMBY thing happening in Huntsville to block progress. And so I was very optimistic about my likelihood of success. And what I found was San Francisco was having success in getting housing, and I could be wrong, but from what I can see, 70% of San Franciscans rent and like 80% of Huntsvillians own their homes. And so it really doesn't matter. Nothing else matters. I'm not going to get a constituency for housing reform in a city where it would be neutral to negative for the bottom lines of 80% of the electorate. And that 80% is wealthier and whiter and older than the opposition. Like, that's just... So my point is that these kind of cultural vibes issues, generally speaking, are going to be subservient to real-world pocketbook issues. But they do matter. But I think they matter less in terms of the particular issue. And I think they matter a lot more in terms of the way that voters feel that the party and the electeds, the candidates, feel about them. So I think that the Democratic Party and progressives have alienated a lot of voters, particularly like rural voters, less because they disagree with them on any particular issue and more because the issues we choose to focus on and the way that we talk about those issues make those voters feel alienated and condescended to and judged and distanced.
Do you mean social issues?
Yeah. And again, these distinctions are a little bit false, but yeah, like when we talk about like trans women in sports or whatever, that is the issue du jour to some extent. But I don't think voters are going to the polls because they're so incensed about trans women in sports. I think they feel like Democrats look down on them and judge them and think they're backwards. To summarize, like, I think at the end of the day, it's easy to overestimate these cultural issues because the punditry loves to talk about them and because people who are really into politics like to argue about them. But like when it comes to, especially at the local level, like who gets out of their butt and goes and who writes checks and like, you know, how things happen, it's people's paychecks. Like that's what it comes down to. People's housing wealth, their bread and butter issues. And I'm not saying that these cultural issues don't matter. But I'm saying that the way that they matter is like on a do these people like me basis, if that makes sense.
So this fits with, you know, one of the conclusions coming out of, I think, the last election was how much this was an election determined by the cost of living. that housing played a huge role, that the biggest shifts to the right were in places where the cost of housing had gone up the most, even in very blue places. They didn't shift to like supporting Trump, but they shifted in that direction. It was places where the cost of living. And I'm pretty persuaded by the argument that like if the Democrats want to win, they need to fix their NIMBY problem. And they need to get, the big Democratic cities need to bring down the cost of housing, in part because the people who are paying a lot don't like it, and in part because like big blue cities are the economic engines of the country, and they're where the majority of the jobs are. And there are lots of people, you know, I know lots of people who, since the election, I live in Denver, would love to move to Denver because Colorado, particularly like trans friends who would love to move to Denver because Colorado is extremely trans friendly. Denver is extremely trans friendly. It's a safer place to be, but Denver is too expensive for a lot of them. Even people with, you know, skills that tech sector skills where they could find work or other professional skills. So bringing down the cost of housing would enable all of that. But at the same time, like the cultural issues, my problem with, or my hesitation, or I guess the concern I have in trying to figure out how to take them more seriously, is that in a lot of cases, the concerns that people have are like manufactured crises or moral panics, like the women in the trans women in sports. There are effectively none participating, especially post-puberty, like trans women participating in women's sports. The number across the whole NCAA is like a dozen over the last years. It's basically none. The concerns about it were very clearly manufactured by bad actors who saw this as a way to drive a wedge in the culture war by stirring up concern, highlighting the handful of instances where it happened. And so I don't know what like being nicer about their concerns or taking them more seriously looks like when or talking about them in a way that makes them seem more worthy than they are. And maybe I'm being like dismissive in exactly the way you're describing. But like, how do you deal with like, on the one hand, they really care about this, but on the other hand, the reason they care about it is because they've been fed a whole lot of misinformation and disinformation by bad actors who are intentionally trying to stir up a political movement in order to take advantage of it.
I think in terms of talking about trans women in sports, yeah, I mean, it's a moral panic. It is a non-issue by any possible objective measure. I mean, and it's moral panics left and right, right? Like the whole thing, we're going to ban pornography. Like my brothers in Christ, look at online gambling. Like that's an actual problem affecting young men. Like online pornography is a total scapegoat. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like just don't talk about it. Like if somebody brings it up, just be like, this is a non-issue. Here's what I'm going to do for working families to make sure that you have a job, that your sons have jobs, that you can feed your family, and that you can afford housing.
But isn't that what the Democrats did?
Did they?
You know, like, isn't that what the Harris campaign, like, they talked about, so they, granted, actual housing policy wasn't great, but they talked about the cost of living going up. They were heavily focused on kitchen table issues. They weren't, Harris was not out there talking about trans rights, neither was Waltz. Like, it seems like they were taking this, you know, that the mainstream Democratic candidates aren't typically centering these kinds of cultural issues.
No, they're not. That's true. But they're also not really talking about solutions. I mean, okay, so the Harris campaign had two housing proposals. One was going to stimulate demand, which is going to not help. The other would have, increased supply, which would be good. in terms of any other kitchen table issue, I mean, she talked about immigration reform. I don't remember any real specifics about that. Her solution for high prices was to ban grocery stores from gouging, from quote unquote price gouging, which is like, no. And it's not even like a good idea in terms of like generating discussion. It was, it didn't accomplish anything really. And so I would say there was a lot of opportunity there to talk about, what are you going to do about market consolidation? What are you going to do about corporatism? What are you going to do about, talk about occupational licensure. I think the Democratic Party has an opportunity to talk about industrial policy. I think one thing the Republican Party does that gives them a tremendous advantage is, first of all, they spend a lot more airtime talking about the problems. You know, marriages are down, fertility is down, male joblessness. I don't hear Democrats really talking that explicitly and that at length about the actual issues facing Americans. It's a lot of vague platitudes. And then the Republicans say, we're going to fix it. We're going to do this for you. And they don't talk about the policies very much because their policies are dumb and aren't going to work, but they talk about outcomes. Everybody's going to have a job. Everybody's going to be able to afford housing. It's lies. Like, there's no way to get from where we are to where they say they're going to take us, especially with the policies that they've posited. And looking at their track record, it's all been lies. But like, the Democrats I've seen, like, it, obviously I don't think Democrats should lie, but like, make some kind of vision of a better future for the people you're trying to win over in any kind of way that indicates that you understand the problems that they're facing and you want to go, you want to take them where they want to go. And then posit some policies that might actually have a chance of getting them there. Reforming occupational licensure isn't going to solve the male joblessness problem, but it will help. And it's a good idea, and it's something to talk about besides trans women in sports.
Yeah, I think there is one of the things that I notice is, I think you're right that the right has been, certainly over the last decade or so, much more vocal in talking about what we might call like cultural problems that people are feeling. So the joblessness and loneliness and feelings of lack of access to success among men, particularly working class men or young men, the deaths of despair, and the fentanyl crisis. Like, they talk about this as, the problem is that they talk about these kind of cultural issues that people are feeling as failures of liberalism. Right? Like, these are, it's because we had liberalism as opposed to collectivism and illiberalism and theocracy and whatever version of it you want to find in some weird corner at the National Conservative Conference. But they talk about it as a failure of liberalism. And then liberals respond to this with this real hesitation to talk about features of culture being good or bad. Talk about like this, yes, like this loneliness epidemic. They'll say, they'll kind of like, have we like policy levers we can pull? But there isn't, it feels like there's this real, there's like a collapse in people's feelings of sources of meaning. And the right has been very good at this. This is all like Jordan Peterson's whole shtick is telling young men, like, yes, you're feeling a loss of meaning, and here's the solution. And of course, his solutions range from either just like utterly banal, like clean your room, to quite damaging, like the problem is the women and their feminism, or the Christian, the white Christian nationalists, like what you need to feel a sense of meaning is this like ethnic and religious solidarity that involves excluding all of these people, or the Josh Hawleys, like what you need in order to return the sense of meaning and purpose in your life is like a return to a pastoral America where we all work the land and the eggheads aren't telling us what to do. Like, all of these are bad, but the left and libertarians have been really bad at offering alternatives. Like, they just want to talk in the language of policy. And they just want to talk in the language of institutions and economics and kind of like the nerdy stuff that wonks do. And they want to stay very far away from engaging on that. And I think they have different reasons for that. But yeah, I think there has to be like that level of engagement of, yes, there is this collapse of meaning, but the alternatives that you're giving aren't good. But in order to make that case, you have to offer better alternatives. Because you can't just be like, we have nothing to say, but what they're telling you is bad, because you want to hear the solutions, which I think is an important point you made, is that it doesn't matter. Like people, the solutions might not work, but the person who's at least giving you a story about how they're going to solve this is more compelling than the person who, this is a problem for libertarians in general, is like our solutions are emergent processes, like the market will figure it out. And like, yes, that's true, but it doesn't feel like, it feels like saying, well, I'm going to solve your problem by doing nothing. And that's a hard sell to a lot of people.
Yeah, I think actually if you want to win people over and really even just get their attention, you don't need solutions. And you certainly don't need solutions that make sense or work. But you have to talk about the problems. You have to acknowledge, you have to openly state, these are the problems that you think are problems. I think they're problems too. And after that, if you have solutions, all the better. But you can have all the solutions in the world. But if you're not saying that first part, no one cares and you've won no one over. So that's where I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. Libertarians mess up. I think, yeah, you're absolutely right. Our solutions are either technocratic and complicated or are emergent. And so one example that I like to give is on the gender wage gap, which is definitely an interesting problem in terms of like the way it's discussed now versus, you know, 10, 15 years ago when I was first thinking about it. But 10, 15 years ago, the libertarian response to the gender wage gap was, well, once you correct for years in the workforce, college major, hours worked per week, blah, 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 it virtually disappears. And so it's not a problem. We don't need to think about it. And then the Republican response was women should stay home. And the Democratic response was we need to mandate equal wages. And my thought was, okay, so it does go away almost when you correct for those things. But why are women making these different choices? And maybe that's not a thing that we could or would want to try to legislate. I don't want to create quotas for majors or, you know, board seats or whatever. But that doesn't mean it's not worth talking about, right? If we care about human flourishing, if we care about economic growth, then these choices women make, if they're inhibiting our ability to participate in the economic system and create widespread prosperity, which there's a lot of evidence they are, because women's entrance into the labor market is responsible for billions and billions of dollars in economic growth for the United States. And so if we're artificially limiting our participation, that's robbing us of prosperity. So why aren't we fully participating? Could it be our gender norms around whose career takes precedence in a couple have anything to do with depressing women's wages? Well, it turns out that the real predictor of the gender wage gap is marriage and childbirth. So probably. And just because we aren't going to mandate people changing their ideas about gender doesn't mean it's not worth thinking about and talking about. I think that is one of the big failures of libertarianism. It continues to be one of the big failures of libertarianism is that if there isn't a government solution to the problem, then it's not a real problem. But like that, A, isn't true, and B, is extremely alienating to people who disagree with you and think it is actually a problem and it is worth thinking about. So if we have all these brilliant minds that are focused on how to get the perfect capital gains tax rate, and nobody's bothering to think about, like, how are our ideas about sex and gender influencing our economic growth? That's what do we have to offer people, really?
I think that's a critical point. And I think that really gets to the heart of a lot of it, that there is this real sense that unless this is a question about government action or inaction, it's not worth talking about. And I think it's largely an incoherent position to take, in part because if you care about government action or inaction, you do that because you have reasons. Like, there's some reason that led you to care about this thing. Like, I think it is wrong for government to coerce people. Well, okay, why? What's the underlying moral principle? And then if you have an underlying moral principle, that underlying moral principle will also lead you to other conclusions about other things. Like, it would be weird to wall off and say, like, I only have moral principles when they apply to the state, but in the rest of the domain of human experience, I don't, is an awfully odd spot to put yourself. And then you get into these weird situations where it's like, okay, so say that the standard solution to businesses discriminating against racial minorities in kind of typical right libertarian land is like, the market will fix this. The market will address racism because it's inefficient to, if you're not willing to hire Black people, then someone else can hire them and they're not competing with you for their labor, so they can get a better deal and they can outcompete you and so on. Or racism in society will go away because people will make choices like in the marketplace of ideas. But then in the marketplace of ideas, if you say, I think this person's a racist, you're told you can't say that because that would be cancel culture, right? Like, to call out racism or sexism or ethno-nationalism or whatever it happens to be would be cancel culture. So there's this real, like, we only want to talk about this one thing, but also, like, if you care about that one thing, it's wrong to talk about anything else. The solution to these issues is not state action. In fact, state action is, reinforces a lot of these problems. But you have to talk about them, and it's okay to say, like, this is not the best way to be, and I think that you should behave differently. I think that treating women like this or having these norms and expectations is not healthy, or digging into the history, because that's the other part of it. Like, your point about, okay, yes, if you control all these variables, but how do these variables end up? Similar stuff happens with racial disparities. Okay, yes, if you control for these variables, but how did we end up in this situation? And there's often a real, not just like lack of curiosity about social history and the emergence of norms, but a hostility to looking at it. There's just this desire to, like, we only look at the current moment and we just analyze the current moment. It's a refusal to engage. And I find it profoundly frustrating because, one, libertarian theory has a lot to say about these kinds of issues. And two, if you refuse to engage, then people who don't share your values will dominate the conversation. And it means that the conversation and the solutions proposed will not be in line with your values. And so you're like opting out of the most important conversations for a huge number of people. I think a lot of it is just like, people don't want to be challenged. They want to explain away these things. Or there's like a tribalism of like, this is an issue that's really salient to these people I don't like. And so by acknowledging that it's a real question, it's a real problem, even if the solutions they're offering aren't the right ones, I'm like giving them credibility in a way I'm uncomfortable with. And I think we desperately have to overcome that.
I think we have to decide what we're doing here. I think we need to be real about, this is the kind of thin, thick libertarianism distinction. And the reality is, like, there's no way it makes sense, like you said, to fetishize the state in that way, to say, I only care about what the state does or doesn't do. And so any kind of oppression or theft or overreach or, you know, just not taking advantage of full opportunities happening outside of this thing that we call the state, I'm totally uninterested in. Like, the only reason anyone would ever do that is that it makes it easier to align with the right. Like, if we can just ignore like racism and sexism and homophobia and authoritarianism, like as a concept, then it makes it easier for us to align with authoritarians who also want low taxes. And you know what? You're allowed to do that. But like, that's all there is to it. It doesn't make sense, you know, in any other context to do quote unquote thin libertarianism and to fetishize this relationship that people and groups have with this apparatus we call the state. And then the other thing I want to say is just like, and this is a real problem for libertarians, and I understand why it is, but it is something that we need to think about, I think. Are we doing politics or are we masturbating? Like, if you want to sit in a room and like go over what you think, again, like the ideal, like, I don't know, like form of immigration policy would be, and you want to run the numbers and create models and game it out and then write white papers about how like this is the ideal immigration policy, you're allowed to do that, you know? Like, I'm not going to yuck your yum, and I'm sure you can find donors that will pay you to do it and have a good time. But like, if you're not winning converts, if you're not making a case, if you're not doing politics, if you're not trying to get power, if you're not winning hearts and minds, then like, it's not relevant. Like, you have a hobby and you're doing that. And so we, like, that's part of the reason we need to be thinking about talking about these problems that matter to people, as opposed to just outlining the policies that would get us to what we think our ideal society would be. Because you can have the best policy in the world, but if nobody's paying attention, if nobody's persuaded, if you're not part of the conversation, then it doesn't matter.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reimagining Liberty. If you'd like to listen to future episodes free of ads and sponsorships, you can become a supporter for just a few dollars a month. Head to www.aaronrosspowell.com to learn more.